Welcome to Lexis, the podcast all about language and linguistics. I'm Lisa Casey.
I'm Jackie Glancy.
And I'm Dan Clayton. So on this episode of Lexis, we're really pleased to welcome Dr. Alex Baratta, who is a senior lecturer in language, linguistics and communication at the Manchester Institute of Education, University of Manchester, has written various books about accent and has done a lot of research on accentism and accents more broadly. So welcome, Alex. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we'll go straight into the first question, which is about accents, essentially. You've done loads of work on accents and accent attitudes. What's the appeal of accents to you?
Well, it's personal to start out with because I was born in Los Angeles. My father was from the Bronx. My mother is actually from the local area, from Ashton-under-Lyne. And she met my dad in LA in the 60s. She was over there as a nanny. And to cut a long story short, as a boy, I was back and forth between the two countries quite a lot. And I made no attempt to change or modify my accent, but I think we pick up languages very easily as children, so why not accents, especially if it's the same language you're still speaking? And as a result, I did. So I'd go back home, being LA, and people would say, "You're from England." I say, "No, I'm not, but you sound English." "Well, I live there now, and you know, I go to school." So it made me aware of how a change in accent can affect how people perceive us and how we perceive ourselves, because it's not just about sounds. It's a very important point I want to make. It's a proxy, it's a symbol for other categories. Most obviously, national origin, regional origin, more deeply, race, ethnicity, class, and so on. So any attack on accent or any positives for that matter might be indirectly saying, "Well, I like you because I like where you're from. I like the country, or I like you sound like me." It's the same shared, say, ethnic identity or something of that nature. So it's a personal interest, but it's also more professional. I just feel it's great to listen to people's different voices and try and pinpoint where they're from. I just enjoy it.
No, well, definitely. I mean, it's interesting that this sort of stuff arises from sort of personal experience, doesn't it? And then leads into a whole kind of field of work. Yeah. I know kind of one of the things about accent attitudes is, you know, as linguists, we're always saying mustn't be prescriptive about accents, mustn't kind of, you know, make judgments about accents that offend people. But then at the same time, I do feel very positively to some accents. And particularly when you said the word Bronx in the way you said it, that immediately triggers for me, that signals a whole kind of identity and a worldview, which, you know, it captures something, doesn't it?
It definitely does. And having an Italian surname and being from the Bronx,
yes.
And then, you know, everything from Scorsese movies to all kinds of ideas and schema.
Yeah. And I guess that, you know, works the other way as well, in terms of sort of negative connotations and representations for some people, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I think that's what it is. It's if a group is stigmatized for whatever reason based on ethnic, racial, class identity, as well as the national and regional identity and origin, then the language they use will also be stigmatized. And it's passed on to the speaker. And it may sound very simplistic, but that's the whole point. I mean, stereotyping, for good or bad, is a time-saving device. And this is what it is. And people will say, no, it's the sounds that bother me. I would disagree. I don't think any human sound, and by sound, I mean phonemes, are inherently one or the other. And we can say, no, that action sounds sexy. That sounds ugly. Mm-hmm. And to just give one example, a broad Liverpool accent, if a word ends with a k sound, mm-hmm. will become more like a sh. So I'll be back. Mm-hmm. And people can hear that and say, okay, you sound like you're congested and such, and you have a, you know, you're clearing your throat. We get the exact same sound in Spanish though, like the Spanish J, now it sounds wonderful and romantic.
Right.
What gives?
Yeah.
It's the stereotypes we associate with Liverpool or Spain in general. And I say we, as maybe people from Britain and the United States, go to Spain, of course. If you're from Andalusia, then you're seen as stupid. The accent's stigmatized. Whereas to me, it sounds Spanish. So I just think of paella and sangria.
Yeah.
So we're very fickle when it comes to sounds. But I think it's the stereotypes we hear, not the sounds per se.
Okay. Yeah. So I think many A-level students and teachers will have come across your work on accent and teacher identity. And I've definitely seen students reference it in their exam answers for A-level. When you did that work and when you wrote the book Accent and Teacher Identity in Britain, you identified some of the kind of pressures on teachers to change their accents. Can you tell us a bit more about the research that you did and what you found and where that sort of led you with your thinking with that?
Yeah, of course. It started off with a study I did with 92 participants who were all from Britain, asking them if they ever had modified their action in some way. How did that tie in with identity? Why did they do it? How did it actually come across? You know, what sound did they actually change from and to? There were six teachers in the study, all of whom said, yes, I have been told to do it. In one case, a job interview was going to be stopped if I didn't modify my accent. So I thought, well, let's look at this in the teaching context specifically. So I took those six teachers, then I did two separate studies with teacher trainees from two Northern and two Southern universities. Then I did a final study with nine teachers of different levels, primary, secondary, private and public schools alike, and put that all together to see how relevant is accent when teachers are training to become teachers. Well, obviously, it's relevant in the sense that, you know, we all have one. We're going to speak all day, and especially if you're teaching phonics. What I'm finding, though, is teachers are told not to change their actions as such, but to modify them to sound less broad. Because I think the issue with broad accents, what does that mean, broad? It means an accent which has the telltale sounds, which I think in just one or two words can pinpoint, not just a city region, but maybe a locality within the city. The point with that is very often working class individuals tend to have accents just like that. Middle class, what do? They take away these, as I call them, phonological giveaways, these sounds which pinpoint you right away. And in doing so, less easy to know where you're from. And as a result of sounding more, as people might say, quote, neutral and less regional, then the class-based stereotypes kind of, if not disappear, if you don't know where you're from, then it's probably because you are middle class. You made an effort, like received pronunciation. We don't know where you're from if you speak RP. We just know you're of upper class or middle class. And I think that's what's happening. So the example with the Liverpool, I'll be bah. Well, three words. Okay, we know you're a Scouser. But if you speak posh Scouse, it's going to take a couple more sentences, maybe even more, to finally ask, are you from Liverpool by any chance? Whereas I'll be bah more right away. And so with teachers, if they have accents which are seen as broad and potentially stigmatized, what are the implications for teaching? There's nothing in the teacher's standard that says you have to modify your accent. It just says you have to use standard English. Yeah. We're both using it right now, but we sound different. So with teachers with broad accents, they are being told by mentors to modify, especially if they're from the North, even if they're going to be teaching in the North, where accent will not be a hindrance to understanding. But that's the official line from mentors, at least in my study, you have to be understood. Although two did say you sound, quote, unprofessional.
Right. So, I mean, just thinking about where that sort of leads, I mean, you certainly talk in your book about, you know, at least raising the question of a discussion being started around using some kind of, I guess, sort of regional standard or moving towards, you know, the idea of perhaps kind of modifying accents in some way. I mean, how do you feel about that as advice for teachers?
Well, I'm not really sure. It was never an ideal solution. But I think something needs to be addressed regarding accent, because in the teacher's standards, yes, we can all use standard English. There is nothing standard about accents. Officially, at least, there is no standard British accent. You might say the de facto standard has always been received pronunciation or standard Southern British English as its modern day equivalent. But standard English is about grammar and vocabulary. As I said, we're both using it right now. We sound different. Who cares? No big deal. But because nothing's mentioned about accent, I think it's because it's a bit of a minefield. You start telling someone you sound too broad or by implication working class. It's not a protected category, though. If we did protect British accents, I think we would be protecting class. But if we then say, well, let's have standard regional accents, well, we're still then saying it's a standard. And if who decides what is what it is? But I think there's definitely varieties of every major region, of course, Mancunian, Scouse, Geordie, Brummie, which are less broad. But it takes more time to know that you're from Birmingham or Liverpool and such. So you can still sound regional. No one's suggesting otherwise. I don't think they could. I don't think we could say, okay, you sound like you're a Scouser, switch to RP. But they're saying don't sound too regional. Get rid of those telltale sounds. And some of the examples given were switch from Bath Bus to Bath Bus. Don't say WOA. The London teacher was told to, you know, write the word water with a capital T. And a guy from Rossendale was told the interview is going to stop for a PGCE unless you modify your accent. I can't hire you. They'll complain. Why we taught, you know, hired this man to teach our children English. So this stuff does go on, this accentism, perceived it might be, but there's no legal recourse. I honestly think, this is my opinion, but I honestly think that what it is, it's a case of it's a hot potato. Let's not go there. let's assume if people are moving into certain middle-class professions, they will know that you're supposed to modify your action, not just change your clothes, but or whatever other aspects of nonverbal and verbal communication. But it's kind of an unwritten rule, I think. You're supposed to change your action. Why did you not do that? Why are you saying, go home, as one Yorkshire teacher did and was told to say, go home? Why? Well, it's who I am. And there can be a linguistic tug of war between mentors and teachers.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's also perhaps something there about the way in which, I guess, that there's a lack of language education among the people who set language policy in the country. You know, I think, you know, when you look back at the way in which Ofsted and the HMI have kind of functioned in the past and how loose they've been when some of their descriptions of language, I mean, even some of their definitions of standard English are kind of questionable. And I think linguists would probably argue about some of the ways in which they talk about standard English and write about it in some of the documents around education. It does seem to me that there's a lack of linguistic education among some of the policymakers. So a conversation around accent would be a really positive thing to have. But of course, as you say, there are those different tensions, aren't there, pulling teachers in different directions. It does seem to be quite a minefield. But you're not really suggesting in your Accent and Teacher Identity in Britain book that it's a good idea for there to be a regional standard for everyone to follow. It's more that you're inviting a conversation about it. Is that the right characterization of it?
Definitely. Let's just touch this, you know, get to this topic, you know, this white elephant, rather than pretend it doesn't exist. Because I think it is an issue for some teachers more than others. Some teachers may not care. You know, my mentor told me to modify my accent. And they'll say, yeah, you know, so what? Just as I change my clothes to teach, I want to present to professional limits. But that's part of the issue. There's no such thing as an unprofessional accent. These are societal labels, not linguistic ones.
Yeah.
How about me being, you know, elitist as a linguist? I think society knows this already, that no combination of vowels and consonant sounds can tell someone's intelligence level or friendliness or trustworthiness. But society decides, put these combination of sounds together. You sound like you're from, for example, the Bronx. Therefore, you are potentially gangster, uncouth, unladylike, uncivilized. You know, these kinds of things. But I think a discussion is needed between mentors and, crucially, between the teachers and the mentors, the people on the ground level, not the people who probably sound a certain way making their decisions. And I say sound a certain way, not to stereotype, but maybe they are private educated, speak RP of some form, wouldn't have broad regional accents themselves. Mm. But regional accents in Britain, that is by definition how most accents are. Only a minority speak RP or some variety of RP. So I think a discussion is needed just to ask the question, what are the standards, if any, for accent? And if the answer is, as long as you're understood, that's all that matters, well, I would agree, because beyond the school gates, children especially, you know, are going to hear a wide variety of accents, some British, some foreign, might not start in the classroom.
And I think there was an article you wrote for The Conversation in 2018 where you raised that point. You know, you said it's time to have a discussion about whether or not more socially acceptable versions of regional accents should become official standards in UK workplaces. But also you said, ultimately, we all have an accent of some kind. So if a candidate is otherwise fully qualified for the job, then surely in this day and age, an accent shouldn't be seen as a linguistic liability. So,
and I think the example I give is if two candidates were having a phone interview to start and as much as possible had identical CVs, brilliant, fully qualified. One spoke, let's say, RP or standard Southern British English, and one spoke with a broad regional accent. Both British now. Who would be more likely to go to the next level and have an in-person interview? Well, I don't know. I can't say. I'm saying a job interview, let's say teaching or banking, something that's, if I can use the word professional, although it's a loaded word. But I know the perceptions would be very different. I mean, that much I can say. That's, I think, a given. But would the perceptions be such that they would be, oh, no, you might be qualified, but if you're not going to change your accent, you're not going to put that finishing touch on the presentation, then we don't want you. So I think it's maybe in some cases, not about the accent per se, but about presumed attitudes of the speakers of accents. You're not willing to play the game. You're not changing your accent to sound more professional. So we don't want you. Mm. I don't think that's a contrived scenario. I really don't.
But I guess you could, the counter argument to that maybe, or a different sort of take on it might be that the rules of the game need to be changed. And how do we do that without actually people using their genuine personal accents that mean so much to them?
Yeah, because there's a lot of evidence, too, that students, if they hear that Miss or Sir sounds like me, they can warm up to them more.
Yeah.
Here in my study from Croydon, and had a strong, what she called strong South London accent, and would use glottal stuff. So say, "Whoa," things like this. So did the students. So they felt that she was more approachable because she wasn't putting on linguistic airs and graces, more authentic, more real. Not to say people are fake if they modify, I don't mean that. But that was her take on being professional. Whereas the mentor said, "No, the way you speak is not professional." Well, if the students are more, feel more comfortable with you, surely that's professional. And of course, it depends on the job too. But the Sutton Trust did say that working class British children and young adults are not getting into certain professions like banking, partly because of accent. I say partly also about clothes, clothing choices, hence the title, The Brown Shoes Effect. But accent is certainly part of it. And I think it is about quote unquote playing the game.
Yeah.
When it's in our club, you got to modify how you speak.
There was some interesting stuff from Accent Bias Britain a couple of years ago where they talked about some of the work they'd done in trying to address accent attitude, accent prejudice. And I think they were particularly looking at sort of legal profession. And some of the sort of approaches around that seem to be around making listeners a bit more aware and alert to different accents. But also, I think they found one of the main things was if the content had more professional sounding vocabulary in it, then that had a bigger impact in shaping people's attitudes and perhaps sort of got around some of the sort of initial accent prejudice to things like, for example, MLE. I mean, what do you make of attempts to sort of counter accent prejudice in that sort of way?
Well, I think one way is to educate people about how accents develop and how it is just about sounds, and sounds per se can never dictate someone's anything. The evidence of people speaking RP have been going door to door and stealing stuff from people's houses. You wear a suit and tie, you speak RP. Oh, you're trustworthy. No, you're not. You're going in and taking the jewelry, pretending to be from the gas board or something like that. Ultimately, it is arbitrary, because if they had built the capital of Britain on the River Mersey, not the Thames, if all the power had been concentrated in the north, not the south, and by that I mean political, educational, economic power, then if the Liverpool accent still evolved the same way, so Lancashire, North Dublin, and such, then the standard British accent, as far as society is concerned, would have been Liverpool. I don't know what that would make RP. We might say RP sounds horrible. It's, you sound strange, you sound lit. So people say, oh, that's not possible. It is possible because it's all arbitrary. It's just who has the power. Whoever has the power, their language will have power conferred onto it. Not because RP sounds inherently one or the other, but it's a case of mind over matter. It's really about psycholinguistics, how the mind processes language, not because anything is inherent. These, you know, glottal stops, which people frown upon, especially in education. Arabic has glottal stops. No Arabic speaker would think twice. It's just a part of Arabic from Morocco to the Gulf. No one would question it. And that same sound is suggesting congestion is used in Spanish, and no one thinks twice about Spanish having sounding harsh. It's a romance language. Nothing to do with romance, but it's the one we usually have a positive connotations of. So I think it helps a lot to learn there's nothing inherent. It is essentially random. It's about who has the power. Therefore, their language will have power. And to see that, you know, the reality is most people in Britain have regional accents. So we need to be more aware of this.
Yeah.
And that has, not just what BBC News reports, which is great, but I think in the world of work, to include law, teaching, banking.
So just thinking about something you wrote recently for The Conversation, which I think was in just in the last week or so, you were talking about, I think, was it about sort of aviation accents?
Yeah.
And there was a line I thought in that which I thought was really interesting. You said no combination of vowel and consonant sounds is inherently difficult to understand. Rather, the degree to which someone is familiar with an accent will dictate how much they understand. It's a matter of accent exposure. And yeah. I thought that was just a really interesting kind of take. You know, is that really the kind of way perhaps to get around a lot of this sort of accent prejudice? Is it to expose people to more variation earlier and to kind of almost like sort of prime the listener rather than put the onus on the speaker?
Yes, I think so. Because for those who argue, as some might, you know, I have no issue with accents, but I have to understand the speaker, especially if it is in the airplane. I totally agree. So it would be a twofold benefit. One is to make people more aware of accents so they can understand a wide variety, be they native speakers of English or not, both listener and speaker. But also to eliminate, well, or hopefully reduce the prejudice, because when you hear it repeatedly, then it becomes less of a novelty. The problem is, though, without that, you know, and even with it, I suppose there are some that won't change. They find it hard to change their attitudes because they hear a broad, let's say, Mancunian accent or anywhere in Britain. And they might have a, I'm not blaming the media entirely. When you think of TV shows like Shameless, Frank Gallagher has a broad Mancunian accent. But then when you look at where he lives and what he does and how he dresses and what he eats and drinks and smokes, then it's all this negativity accompanying it. Why can we not just take all of that out, but keep the accent? And he can still wear a three-piece suit, defend clients in a courtroom, or teach at Oxford University. You see, that's the thing. And we might not think, oh, the accent doesn't match up with the image because we expect certain images. But I think this is one way to definitely help people understand, because it is a lack of exposure. Most British people could understand me just fine, because a lot of American TV shows, people speak general American. When I first went to the city of Philadelphia, an individual gave me directions to, I was going to New Jersey. I couldn't understand a word he said. I never heard a Philly accent. I'm more familiar with it now, but for his time, it was like completely, oh my gosh, what did he just say?
Yeah. I had a similar experience to the first few episodes of The Wire. And
Baltimore.
Yeah. When you tune into it, you know, you get it. And that, you know, you feel like you pick it up, you understand it.
Definitely.
And it's interesting about the sort of social connotations of accents you mentioned. Because, I mean, I was thinking about, you know, you mentioned Mancunian and Shameless. But, I mean, I remember growing up in the UK in the 80s and, you know, constantly the Brummie accent was used as a kind of butt of jokes. You know, it was almost like a sort of code for stupid.
Yeah.
But then when you kind of think about how that's changed, there's been, you know, someone like Alison Hammond, who's on TV a lot, Peaky Blinders, which has kind of, you know, made it a much more fashionable accent. Someone like Jack Grealish, who speaks with a Brummie accent, or at least, you know, Black Country, West Midlands. That kind of cultural shift can also kind of influence the way in which people view an accent, can't they? And see it as being more sort of socially acceptable. I guess going back to the 60s and the Beatles and lots of people who weren't from Liverpool affecting a slightly kind of Scouse accent as well. These things can change, can't they?
Definitely, because society changes. So I think now with a lot more accent variety on places like the BBC, granted, these are not necessarily broad accents with some exceptions, but they are clearly regional. They're not RP. So that's going a long way. Not just we trust you to use a broad regional accent when you're a DJ, but no, we trust you to read the news with a regional accent. Well, that's saying something right there. And certainly back in the 60s, the British kitchen sink cinematic movement, where suddenly regional accents were in vogue, like, you know, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning and A Taste of Honey. That certainly helped. And Coronation Street, of course. From a linguistic point of view, strictly speaking, it would be maybe ideal if there's no feelings one or the other, just neutral, but it never happened. It's good to have positive connotations, but in some ways, those can be as, you know, unfortunate as the negative ones, because we might give people much more credit than they're due because of how they speak. He speaks RP, therefore he must be a certain class bracket, probably.
Yeah.
He would never lie. He's trustworthy. Well, how do you know? You never met the guy. You just know his voice.
Yeah, exactly. Accent does seem to provide huge amounts of kind of media discussion. I mean, we've seen loads of stories about accent in the last week or two based on, you know, work from people like Amanda Cole and, you know, looking at the way in which there's young people in the southeast of England and the changing accents. They've got some of the kind of commentary you get in the media around that and some of the below the line kind of stuff from, you know, online commentators, readers' comments. It's clear that there are hugely negative views about accent and many social stereotypes. It does seem to be a big point of discussion, but also one that it's quite sort of festering and unpleasant at times as well. I mean, what do you make of that sort of the popular discussion around accent attitudes and things like that?
Well, I think it's good, first of all, that people are discussing it much more than perhaps in the 80s or 90s, that it is more discussed. Some would say, well, don't talk about it. But no, I think it's good to discuss. I think it's good occasionally to, you know, have a bit of lighthearted banter about accents. Let's not be too serious. But at the same time, if we're saying, well, you're not fit for the job because of how you speak. And I want to distinguish between accent and simply, you know, prosodic features. I mean, if you mumble or speak in a very quiet voice or have a monotone, well, that you could have that with any accent.
Yeah.
And don't pronounce clearly, which is not the same. Although for some, if you say, well, that's not pronouncing clearly, actually it is for a given region. But if you are pronouncing, enunciating clearly, but simply sound is a different variety, then that's just how it is. That's a reality. And I think it's good that we have more discussions, but I think for some, certain accents will always be associated with certain connotations. And that is just how it is. But I think there's a lot more leeway now by having these discussions and trying to make people more aware. From a linguistic point of view, it is completely nonsensical. I mean, there are other things we can talk about, like why do certain groups, you know, why do working class people tend to have more, if you want to call them, reductions in their speech and clip forms? It's because they're not speaking, their voices are not being held in high esteem, that they have to speak, quote, I'm not going to say clearly, but in full forms. Because if you are a peace speaker, historically you had the power, so you have to speak in these full forms. Because the natural linguistic tendency is not to do so. It is actually to get more reductions, whether it's going to, becoming gonna, and ello, and all this. And not surprisingly, when RP speakers are recorded, not reading from a book, but just having a normal conversation that's on the telephone, they also will have reductions. So shall we go can become schwiege. So we all do it. But if you're going to be facing millions of people as a prime minister or a lawyer, then got to speak not just clearly, not just my best accent, whatever that means, but also completely pronounce every single letter, unless it's a silent letter, of course. So that's another issue. It's not because of any inherent, as some people have thought, lack of intelligence. You're not pronouncing the full form, because people aren't going to be judging me the same way going to be judging a leader of business, of universities, of the country. They'll be judging me because I don't pronounce, let's say, I have more clipped forms. But to say that bath, you know, is anything less than bath and books.
Yeah.
Southerners have that same sound too, as in words like book. Well, then it's okay. But if you say it is in words like books, umbrella, oh, now it's not okay. Yeah. So what's, again, what gives? The same sound, just different context. You know, it's silly.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move to the quick fire questions then. So what's your favorite book about language?
To be honest, I don't have a favorite book. I have favorite books. And actually, I like any books that are introduction level books, intro to linguistics or linguistics for dummies, because it gives a good overview of lots of different branches. So students and enthusiasts can get a lot of information about different branches rather than just focus on one specific topic like social linguistics, which I love to do anyway.
Yeah.
So I think the introduction level book is the most engaging.
Have you got any particular ones that you know struck you when you were first getting into the field?
Well, seriously, I think Linguistics for Dummies, because that is made in a very accessible style of writing. It's not a theoretical book like a textbook per se, although it is theoretical. It's not just simply a description, but it's just really engaging and fun to read, and lots of illustrations, which is key.
Yeah. So second one, what's your favorite linguistic fact or idea?
What I find most fascinating, even though ironically, I don't really study in this area, is constructive linguistics, historical linguistics, seeing how languages are related. Because if languages have similar features, lexical and grammatical, they either came from a shared ancestral form, or they spent time with each other through trade or colonization and started to, you know, become more like each other. So for example, it was once believed widely that Korean was related to Hungarian. Well, that fascinates me. The native Australians originally came from India. So there's some similarities between Australian languages and the Dravidian languages of southern India, apparently, like Kannada and Telugu. Well, that's interesting. So that really fascinates me a lot.
Yeah, I remember reading somewhere, and I think it was speculation about Basque and wondering where on earth Basque came from and how it was linked to other languages.
Especially fascinating. I think it is an isolated language. So no one knows where it came from, unrelated to any other language. So it's an orphan. And there's a few languages like that, but I think Basque has got the most coverage. So I think the general consensus is Basque was the first language to arrive on site or just developed on site in Europe before Romans and the Greeks. No one knows where it came from and no relation to anything else other than ancestral forms of Basque, of course.
Yeah. And then finally, what one bit of advice would you give to a budding linguist?
I would say, obvious though it might sound, find out about linguistics, what it is, because there's so many different branches, and find your niche within. Because a degree in linguistics will give you as a bedrock syntax and phonetics phonology, which you might not be interested in. You might want to go into, like I do, sociolinguistics. So I think it's just an obvious thing to say, it's such a huge field. I didn't realize how big it is, but now I found this is what I'm going to do. And then second, just be more consciously aware of language all over the place. Listen to people's conversations. I do it all the time. I can't help it now. I don't mean to, but I'm always doing it. I'm listening to real language, whether it's accent, vocabulary, or how people have a conversation that goes back and forth. In other words, be an unofficial researcher. Imagine you have a tape recorder. What would you make of the data? Whether it's conversations with people on the bus or how the media uses language, everything from font style to font size to placement of the visuals, how big is the visual? So just look at language all around you, visual, written, spoken, media, academic, journalistic, best friends, mother, father, how we change our language use to accommodate other people. We do it every day and we don't think about it because it's just like breathing. But be more consciously aware. And then you'll realize after just one day of just doing a bit of investigation, like I've suggested, you got a whole bunch of data, which could be in the future, you know, the basis of a 2,000 word essay.
Thanks very much, Alex. That's really interesting.
Thank you, Dan. I mean, I hope you've noticed, to talk about language, I could talk your ear off. So thank you so much for, you know, sending me the email.
So today in Lang in the News, we've got a couple of stories that we thought would be interesting to have a look at. We're going to start by looking at an article in the Daily Mail that considers the language that we use in the workplace. And then we're going to signpost a couple more articles for you that look at inclusive language and then look at Word of the Year.
So the Mail one, is that's about yours sincerely, is it? Is this the one?
That's right, yeah. So it's a little bit of research. I'm not sure whether it's kind of academic research or more of a poll.
It's not academic research. No. It's a survey of 2,000 people by Barclays Life Skills.
Right. Okay.
So we can't, I think, make any claims about academic robustness here. But the findings have been taken as read. Mm-hmm. I think we need to take them with a fairly hearty pinch of salt, given the number of responders.
And it's looking at the difference between kind of older and younger people, is it, and the way that they use language in the workplace.
Yeah, in how they kind of greet people or sign off emails largely, isn't it? So I think they're saying, according to a survey, 2,000 people, 37% described yours sincerely as old-fashioned, while 10% said it was boring. 6% of the 18 to 24-year-olds said that they found the phrase intimidating. And then they talk about other ones like regards and best wishes. Starting an email with dear is falling out of favour. Higher, hey, things like that. So it's kind of interesting looking at the sort of conventions used in workplace emails.
Yeah, and I'd agree they're shifting. I mean, anecdotally, I'd probably agree with them, even though the robustness of the study isn't quite there. And I am talking about my own anecdotal experience. It certainly fits in with sort of this wider informalization sort of theory that I think we might have talked about before, kind of the idea that language, broadly speaking, in its change is becoming more informal. I'd certainly say that was the case in my workplace emails. I don't know about yours.
And I do wonder as well how many people of younger generations actually write any formal letters at all outside the school, and even if that's even a thing anymore, writing a formal letter. So I mean, it's no great surprise that things like dear and yours sincerely are probably being used less and less. And I guess as well, when you've got that kind of leakage, haven't you, between different forms of communication. So I've received emails from students where it's much more like a social media kind of hey, hi kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you kind of think maybe that's a little bit too informal for an email. But I mean, it's not something that particularly bothers me. But then you kind of think, well, maybe you should learn how to write a formal email because you might need to in a workplace. I don't know.
I do think they learn it. It's just that it might be that the email to you isn't something they consider to be one of those. So I'm thinking about, for example, sixth formers. They do UCAS applications, they do job applications, and no, they may not have the kind of formal covering letter that goes off in a post that they're used to. They definitely get taught kind of formal forms. Yeah. And they still write essays in school and they still write in formal ways. I think that these kind of peripheral spaces, like online communicative spaces, are potentially a little grey for them, possibly.
It might be that some of the emails that we send are fairly kind of spontaneous, and you've got that kind of quick kind of interaction between each other, which kind of lends itself more to the instant messaging kind of language that you might use as well.
Yeah, they quote in the Mail article, they quote Dr. Laura Bailey, senior lecturer in English language and linguistics at the University of Kent. She says, changing norms in the workplace are reflected in the language younger employees use and the way communication has changed in general. Email threads and instant messaging platforms have become blended into conversations where formal openings and sign-offs may feel out of place, she says. Yeah. I'd agree with that broadly. Mm. The Guardian actually covers it as well. I mean, it's not really an article. It's one of their little kind of mini
Arse notes thing, is
chats.
It?
Yeah. And their headline is, "Yours sincerely is dead. So how should you sign off an email?" And theirs is kind of lightly humorous. But I mean, perhaps unsurprisingly, we've got some comments underneath the Daily Mail article. We seem to talk about these a lot these days. they're a little angry.
Yeah.
A little angry about it.
But again, they seem to be sort of particularly triggered by Gen Z things. And I do want, I'm sure some of these stories are basically kind of like generation clickbait, aren't they? Mm. You know, so it's hate clicks for older readers. So
I don't know how I feel about reading some of these out, because some of them are really quite unpleasant, but they do seem to be scapegoating any social group that they've decided are to blame for something awful happening in society. And in this case, making immense illogical leaps about how we can blame China, for example, for the loss of Yours Sincerely or Dear, or we can blame young people, or we can blame the teaching profession for indoctrinating children. All of these are comments that come up in the Daily Mail section.
I mean, there's stuff here that's very like anti-trans. So you get someone here who says, "I'm not prepared to take any lectures on grammar from a generation that wakes up in the morning and can't decide whether it wants to be Arthur, Martha, or a bloody teapot that day." I mean, what's that got to do?
I mean, that's literally just transphobic.
Yes, it's just bonkers, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then other people kind of making slightly more reasonable complaints, I suppose, where they're talking about how younger generations need to be versatile about switching between different levels of formality. I mean, it's still a complaint, but I guess there's a basis of something in there.
Yeah, and you could say that that's somewhat legitimate. It kind of says what you said, Dan. In emails to people that should be formal, they should be able to use formal language. And that's fair, and that's fine. As I said, I think, and this reflects what Laura Bailey said, was that, you know, that space is sort of in flux at the moment. The idea of what counts as an email or what counts as just a chat or a conversation, it feels like it's being renegotiated currently. And it probably will go the way of becoming more informal as time goes on, and as the study suggests, albeit not a very robust one.
I do wonder as well if part of it is down to the fact that we tend to be using the same devices for so many different forms of communication. So if you think about using your phone, you're going to be doing work emails on that. Right. You're also going to be WhatsApping in a kind of group, maybe with family, friends, maybe even people from work as well. There'll be social media apps on there too. If you're using the same device, maybe there's a kind of tendency for these things to sort of blend together a bit more anyway.
I find that quite difficult to believe, given how well-versed our young people are generally in their capacity to switch when they're speaking, for example, you know, from speaking to their friends or speaking to a teacher. I don't see why they couldn't do it across different apps. And I suspect that actually we'd be quite surprised at the difference in the way they actually speak to their friends to the way that they communicate with sort of figures of authority. Yeah. Some of the things that I see as someone in school, kind of the chats between students that sometimes come to our attention for various reasons, are nigh on unintelligible to us. Like genuinely, what are they writing? I don't know what's being said there.
Yeah, and so a couple of other stories that might be useful for discussion around, I guess, sort of language and representation, language and gender. There's a really interesting article in The Guardian which looks at attempts across Europe to promote what might be seen as more inclusive language or less gendered language. And it's a really nice article where they kind of look at different attempts that have been made in, for example, France and Italy and Spain and Germany.
Yeah.
To address what might be seen as kind of sexist imbalances, often around things to do with the assumption that the male is the norm. For example, they have a look at French and they talk about, in one paragraph, they say what irks campaigners most is that French grammatical rules make the masculine form of a noun the default over the female. So women on an all-female board of company directors are called directrices. If one man joins the board, they're referred to collectively as directeur. So it's the idea that, you know, the male is default, and discussions there about how they might address that. And of course, I think one of the arguments that you see in several of these stories is about how they've got academies or authorities that regulate language use in the country. So there's the French, L'Académie Française, but there's also, I think, one in Spain that's referred to. Whereas in Germany, there isn't. And so they're kind of suggesting that there's more of an attempt to kind of make a sort of bottom-up change there around what they see as a kind of gender imbalance in language.
Yeah, this article is really nice. It's good for gender. It's good for language change. It's good for looking at political language, because a lot of this kind of suggests that conversations around pronoun use or male and female gendered noun use in particular languages has sort of become politically motivated, that it's representative of some sort of broader left-wing versus right-wing kind of battle that seems to be happening across Europe at the minute. So it's a really, really useful article. We do recommend you go and have a look. Have we got a last one as well?
Yeah, there's a few other ones about kind of word of the year. So I think one of the things we're probably going to see more of, and we'll probably cover in future Lang in the News, is the end of the year, word of the year announcements from the different dictionaries. So Collins has got in first this time, and they've gone for AI as their word of the year, which feels like a fairly kind of sensible choice. It's certainly been used a lot. We had Rishi Sunak and Elon Musk talking to each other this week about AI. There's some really interesting stuff about AI as well from linguists in the US. I think Professor Emily Bender has written quite a lot about it, and I've heard some really good interviews with her. There's lots of language stuff going on with AI, which is really interesting. And I think it'd be nice to sort of come back and talk about that another time.
Our year 12's responses to hearing that AI was the word of the year was, but that's not a word, which led into a really nice discussion about what words are and about what dictionaries are for and things, which is always useful to have with students, especially if they're in year 12 and just kind of starting off their courses too.
Yes, yeah. And I'm sure we'll come back to more stories about that as the other dictionaries do their thing. So there'll be Merriam-Webster, we'll get the Macquarie, I'm sure. Oxford will do theirs. And there'll be lots of commentary about that. So that'll be fun. Just one final quick thing is linguist and friend of this podcast, Rob Drummond, has got his new book out, and it's called You're All Talk. And that's really, really worth having a look at. There's been some great stuff in the coverage of what Rob's written. It's a really good book and great for this course. And loads of really interesting interviews that he's done and articles around it, including one in The Guardian. There's one in The Observer, and he's appeared on various kind of programs as well talking about it. So definitely get that. If you're looking for something for the linguist in your life for Christmas, get that book. It's really good.
Yeah, congrats to Rob for that.